Hey everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Robots Are Coming. And today I'll be interviewing Professor Macy, Assistant Professor of Law at the University of Chicago Law School. Professor Macy specializes in environmental law, energy law, bankruptcy, and the regulation of financial institutions. His work has been featured on the WSJ and Bloomberg's Money Stuff, and he's appeared on forthcoming on Juul, the Stanford Law Review, Penn Law Review, Yale Law Journal, Michigan Law Journal, Harvard Law Review, and Vanderbilt Law Review, Texas Law Review, and Yale Journal of Regulation. He's twice won the Morrison Prize for the most influential environmental law article of the year, Zombie Energy Laws. And I'm going to be talking about specifically his paper on grid reliability through clean energy. My name is Ken Hinn, your host with The Robots Are Coming. Let's get started. So first off, I kind of wanted to get to know your journey with how you first got started in, let's say, your journey from undergrad all the way to law school to where you are now. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey?
Definitely. And thanks for that introduction, Ken. It's really great to be with you. So I was an English major in college, and then I went to do a master's degree in political theory. And like many highly educated humanities majors with little practical skills, I found myself at an investment bank. I learned a lot, but it quickly became apparent that investment banking was not for me. So I applied to law school. And in law school, I went to law school as the U.S. was coming out of the financial crisis. And I loved law school. And I was especially interested in studying sort of regulation. How do we design effective regulatory policies? And one thing that sort of occurred to me was that a lot of the seminal courses that address regulation, administrative law, statutory interpretation, sort of assumed that you would read judicial opinions and statutes, and that would give you evidence of how regulation occurred. And it seemed to me that from my time banking, many of our most pressing regulatory issues, we couldn't really understand effective regulation in that way. The Federal Reserve, for example, does most of regulatory policy through supervision. And it also seemed that just thinking about money and financial instruments was really, really important for understanding how compliance occurs. So then in law school, I was sort of casually interested in climate change. Before I got to law school, and I was very lucky to make a friend in law school who I wrote my first two articles with, who came into law school hell-bent on writing about climate change. And he and I both had finance backgrounds. He'd been in consulting, I'd been at a bank. And so we sort of self-taught ourselves energy law. It seemed, I think to both of us, that a lot of the environmental legal community and the academics in environmental law grew up in an age where they did tremendous work, but their job was to block infrastructure projects, and that the core issue today to reduce power sector emissions or just to decarbonize the economy more generally is to build a lot of stuff, and that there's this sort of 180 degree change that needs to occur in how we think about environmentalism. And so I think I was lucky that I developed some technical skills that allowed me to take a pretty financy approach to studying climate change. And then I got really lucky with having good law school friends who sort of pushed my way into it. And I sort of found myself there largely because I worked at a bank, didn't know what I wanted to do in law school, found that I was better at in law school, you have to do it. I went to Yale Law School, and you have to do an oral argument in front of a professor. And my professor, my small group professor, told me that I was so bad at oral argument that I should consider careers that don't involve litigating. I think he was mostly in jest, but it was clear that I was better at writing academic papers than I might be at being a real lawyer.
Well, I did read one of your papers called Grid Reliability Through Clean Energy, and I do have to commend your great writing skills. I kind of want to talk through your paper My main first question is, what has happened in the wake of recent high profile power failures?
Yeah, so the US grid, there are a few. I think the US grid, we still rely on technology that was mostly developed in the 1970s to transport electricity. And the grid, it's been described as the most complex machine in the world. And it, as a sort of economic, not economic, as a technological innovation, it's truly remarkable. The US initially treated electricity as a natural monopoly and subjected every single part of the provision of electricity to rate regulation. So we granted government exclusive franchises to individual utilities, and we did basically subjected them to a complicated series of price controls, mostly at the state level. So the sort of first thing is it is amazing that we've haphazardly constructed something that essentially powers our entire economy. Energy ranges from 7 to 13% of GDP, but energy academics like to joke it's like the first 7% of GDP. Nothing works without it. But we are now at a point where we have not really updated the grid. And what I mean by the grid is every aspect of generating electric power, transporting it, and then delivering it to consumers on a large scale. And we've been making significant investments, but we've been doing so at a local level. So to give you a sense, you can build transmission lines, you can build small transmission lines that are needed to address immediate reliability needs, or you can build big high voltage, you know, HVDC lines that transport electric power across thousands of miles. And there are huge economic and reliability benefits to building large lines. If there's a hurricane in Florida and lines and generators go down, if you can import electricity from Oregon, that will keep the lights on. One thing we explored in this paper, my co-authors and I, is why is the US, while we're investing billions of dollars a year, struggling so much to keep the lights on, and what does that tell us about like how we can think about managing reliability and managing climate change? To give a concrete example, transmission is regulated at the local, state, and federal level. States often have siting authority. FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, sets rates, but FERC has a complex series of regulations in which it says regional lines, the lines most needed to keep the lights on, to keep costs down, they should be solicited competitively and planned regionally. But local lines, because we're worried that, okay, we just need to make a quick investment to deal with what could turn out to be a crisis, those don't need to go through competition. Since FERC adopted that regulation, now in important regions of the country, 80 to 90% of lines are built locally. And this is just a simple arbitrage sort. You don't have to go through competition to build these local lines. And so we're making significant investments in transmission, but we're not building the lines that would bring solar and wind into the market and that would allow sort of take advantage of scale economies associated with transmission investment.
Great. And my next question for you is, what do you think these extremes of system outages would lead to?
My hope is that I think in the past 3 years, transmission has been seen as a fairly polarized issue, that Democrats want to build transmission because it will reduce power sector emissions, and Republicans think we don't care about climate change, and so why should we do that? I hope that these are wake-up calls, that we've now had pretty devastating blackouts in Texas and Louisiana and Florida. New England is at the brink of having serious reliability issues. California's had reliability issues. And that we start to realize this is also an economic issue, and that essentially critical infrastructure needed to keep our economy running is crumbling, and that the US needs to think very seriously about how to keep the lights on and how to make sure we have a modern transmission grid so that we actually can not just decarbonize, but also make sure that hospitals and homes don't lose heat during winter storms or hurricanes.
I also want to ask a question that's outside of our normal conversation in that, is there something that both Republicans and Democrats agree on in terms of climate change or conservation?
So it's a really good question because I have a fairly free market orientation. And when you look at the history of environmentalism in the US, Richard Nixon created the EPA. The first Bush ran was on a platform of energy independence and cared immensely about climate change. Republicans have historically been very, very concerned about conserving the United States' energy resources. And also, it's only in the last 10 to 15 years where climate change has become such a polarizing issue. My hope, when I talk to my students, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, it seems to me that a lot of young libertarian-oriented students are quite concerned about climate change. But in our politics, climate change has become extremely polarized, and it's hard to see immediate political solutions to that, but I hope at least to the extent there's room to agree on the obvious need to maintain reliable access to energy, that Republicans and Democrats can agree on that. I also hope that as decarbonizing presents enormous economic opportunities domestically, that too is seen, that the US in the manufacturing of solar is already falling behind to China, and that it would be, there may be some room for agreement in just recognizing that there is demand for various resources needed to decarbonize, and the fact that we're polarized on that issue has harmed us economically, irrespective of your views on climate change. But like all issues today, polarization is just really hard, and it's not clear there are easy solutions.
And I know you mentioned China. So how does the U.S. compete with China in terms of energy? As far as I'm aware, the Chinese government is investing more and more on clean energy and technology, and they're very investing in engineering innovations. How would the U.S. compete in such an environment like that?
Yeah, I mean, we are the U.S. it has fallen behind China, especially in solar manufacturing. China's also made more ambitious investments in nuclear in the past decade. And to the extent that some decarbonization, especially in often actually outside of China and the US, might likely involve a great deal of nuclear energy, China may have positioned itself. At least it's built up a pretty healthy lead. I think it would be good for the world if there was an arms race in innovating in clean energy technologies. I do think in some areas, the United States has made very promising innovations. For example, we always joke that fusion is 20 years away, but it may be a shorter 20 years than it was 20 years ago. And a lot of that is work done, much of it done at MIT. But I think it's a simple story that, you know, I would hope the US considers something like a Manhattan Project for fusion and other clean technologies. And I think the benefits to our domestic economy are so obvious that I hope just large-scale investment is one way we think about that.
A Manhattan Project would be an interesting way to have the arms race with China, because I know at the University of California, Berkeley, at the College of Chemistry, there were some leaders of the Manhattan Project. So that's an interesting thing to pass along. And my next question to you, I'm going to go back to your article And I want to ask you, what is the perceived tension between clean energy sources like solar, nuclear, and its reliability?
Yeah, so there are a couple. And one thing you hear that has some truth to it but is often overblown is renewables are intermittent, and so we need to pay for other sources of energy to make sure we have reliable access to power. You also and when you look at many of the most comprehensive decarbonization studies, they do suggest some need for firm power to get deep decarbonization, that you need 20% of the cost of fully decarbonizing are much, much lower if you have about 20% geothermal, nuclear, carbon capture and storage for a set amount of gas. From my perspective, what I think is troubling when you take when you look at it from a legal perspective, is that we should develop markets that will support decarbonization and allow whatever resources can enter the market to and provide reliable power or reduce cost to do so. But as a variety of jurisdictional tensions mean that clean energy policies and reliability policies operate at cross purposes. So to give a concrete example, the core issue energy economists think about is how to make sure you have a generator that operates one time a year or once every few years when it's really, really cold or really hot. How does that generator make enough money to stay in the market? And this is the source of an extensive economics literature, but in practice, a lot of regulators have developed something called a capacity market, where they have a market that pays generators if they're just available to sell electricity, whether they are actually selling it or not. And you can design capacity markets that are relatively innocuous or capacity markets that are bad. But in the past few years, capacity markets are now responsible for 30 to 40% of generator revenues. And they've developed all of these rules that essentially pick and choose generators that will be in the market. And so the reason I'm concerned about this is that to the extent that states or companies like Google say, we will pay a premium for clean power, we then have a regulator saying, okay, but only these resources are eligible. That instead of providing a payment or a market incentive to decarbonize such that regulators don't pick and choose and basically counteract the clean energy policies, I would hope that regulators develop processes that harmonize the reliability policy. So if it is the case that only the resources that regulators have picked can may provide reliable power, that's fine. They will be rewarded in the market, but we shouldn't box out future innovations. So for years, battery storage had performance duration requirements. This gets like very technical quickly, but rules saying you have to operate for 8 hours, which effectively kept every battery out of the capacity market, even though it appeared that 4 hour storage that could store electricity for 4 hours had enormous reliability benefits that was very, very easy to quantify. And so in this paper, we take a fairly deep dive into how regulators have structured reliability markets in a way that counteracts a lot of clean energy policies. And that can mean that no matter what states or even the federal government or companies do to buy clean power, they're unable to those policies are less effective in decarbonizing because the reliability policy says, who cares? We're just going to make sure that the fossil company is A, indifferent to the clean energy policy, and B, sells electricity no matter what. And I think we should be very concerned with those ju jurisdictional tensions. I support a carbon tax, but a carbon tax is not effective if we tell a gas plant you have to operate and you're guaranteed certain revenues.
My next question for you has to do with the legal silos part of your paper. You talked about legal silos extensively. What has legal silos caused for states and regional organizations?
Yeah, so this goes back to the history through which the electric power industry evolved, where it was initially regulated by state public utility commissions. The reason we have federal regulation of electricity is actually because the Supreme Court held that no state could regulate certain types of interstate electricity sales. Interestingly, the Dormant Commerce Clause jurisprudence that led to those decisions is no longer good law, but we have federal regulation of energy as a result. At the same time, the federal government is bar. We wanted to preserve local control of certain parts of the electricity industry. And the sort of the most obvious example is just when states design decarbonization policies without thinking of the federal climate policy, or when the federal reliability regulators design those capacity markets without thinking about how they'll interact with climate policies, they operate at cross purposes. And so those, it's sometimes I think they're nefarious, but in other times, I think they're just accidents of history where the regulators are not considering cross-jurisdictional effects. And so it's resulted in both climate and reliability policies being much, much too costly and also much less effective than they would be if we just paid for what we wanted and harmonized across jurisdictions.
What do you propose for this paper regarding regulating energy law silos?
So there are a few things. The one is we should build a lot more transmission. It's a really boring thing, but building those big metal transmission lines is the easiest climate and reliability policy we can do. At a more kind of technical level, one thing that emerges from this paper is because neither the federal government nor states have authority to regulate comprehensively, we've outsourced a lot of control over the rule market rules to private entities. They're supposed to be nonprofits. They're called regional transmission organizations or independent system operators, or just regional planning organizations. And these entities have huge governance problems. They typically represent incumbent interests. And so they've emerged as a significant roadblock to the types of policies I want. And the other thing that emerges, though my co-authors might quibble with me on this one, is that market-based regulations are more effective at easing jurisdictional tensions than regulatory fiat. So an obvious example is when a regulator goes in, and this has happened with increasing frequency in the last 5 years, and says to a generator, "We're going to take you out of the market because you're so important to reliability and guarantee that you'll receive certain revenues." That kind of regulatory fiat is very, very bad for the kind of jurisdictional harmonization that would make it easier to design optimal climate and reliability policies. And so, to the extent that regulators in the energy space have always been very reluctant to what we call restructuring, but really just move to competitive markets, they've actually exacerbated these jurisdictional tensions. Whereas if you send a price signal, it's much easier to just incorporate a payment for clean energy or a payment for reliability. Whereas if you have a regulatory mandate, there's very little that you can do to harmonize climate and reliability policies.
What would you say would be the next best steps for a senator, a politician, or regulators to ensure that energy is efficient, but also we can also curb the effects of
Yeah. So the most concrete step is, and this it's like two or three sub-steps, but the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission does not have authority to site transmission lines. And even in the planning process, planning is done often by incumbent utilities that have market power in generation and don't want to expose their generators to competition from additional resources. So if I was advising a politician, I would say, do two things. Give FERC or the Department of Energy, siting authority, at least for some big transmission lines, and make sure that planning is done so that you simultaneously think about emissions reductions and reliability. And luckily here, those two go hand in hand, but the planning can't, giving FERC siting authority isn't enough if planning continues to be done by incumbents that don't want to face stiffer competition. So you guys at Berkeley have many of the best transmission modelers in the country. I would rather you guys do it, or people at MIT or Princeton, people, there's these big energy groups than have an incumbent utility that has financial interests that are at odds with keeping the lights on.
I'll be sure to pass the message along to the Berkeley. Yeah. Here. But I do want to ask, are you sure that government institutions, even faith in the University of California, Berkeley, or government, is much better than the free market? Are you sure of that?
No, but I think it's sort of a false binary. So when we think about government planning versus free market, we don't in energy have a market in which customers can just go to suppliers and say, I want to buy stuff. We're starting with an enormous regulatory apparatus that makes that difficult, with a series of price controls and without the infrastructure necessary. So if you want to buy electricity from solar, or if you would like to pay a little more for reliability, you actually often can't do that. And so when I say have planning work that way, I actually think what needs to happen is, or at least what would be preferable, I think of is sort of, it's kind of difficult to even discuss it in terms of free market versus regulation. You want a menu of possible transmission lines that people are willing to pay for. So you can model, like, this line will result in these cost savings to these people, result in these emissions reductions, et cetera. And at the end of the day, I think states should be able to say what their willingness to pay for that is, or customers should be able to say what their willingness to pay for that is. And that involves both very careful modeling. It involves some amount of government oversight to manage the auction, but it actually looks more market oriented from my perspective than the current process, because at least we're facilitating a process by which customers can say what they're willing to pay for various resources, which, given all of the regulatory constraints we have now, they're unable to do. You can't just go and say, hey, you're willing to build some solar arrays, I'm going to pay for it. It's just not possible given the way we pay for electricity. And so I think some amount of government intervention is needed to actually increase some amount of free market, though it would be really, really far from an idealized free market.
Is there an event in history that you would cite as something similar to what you're advising?
Oof. I mean, the U.S. has not recently, but made massive investments in railroads, in highways, and I don't know about highways as much, but these have been you can think of them as sort of public-private partnerships. And I think it does suggest that some amount of government intervention might be necessary for this, but I don't know that that means it's not free market-oriented, especially when you get mired in property rights disputes that private companies may not just be able to seize people's land, and you may not be able to build the scale of infrastructure needed without eminent domain authority, for example. So maybe, but I'd want to be a little careful before saying conclusively, this is just like building railroads in the late 19th century.
And before we end the podcast, I would like to ask you what advice and what would you like to say to future policymakers, future politicians, and future technologists?
One thing I've learned is I'm an academic because my political instincts tend not to be very good. I think So you're asking about politicians, not about academics. I think, one, there is room for agreement in energy, even though the climate issue seems polarized, that getting into the weeds about energy policy, much of which is a lot, is not as sexy as some of the more popular law classes, can lead to incredibly valuable economic benefits and emissions reductions. And across basically every domain we care about, going into details that people tend not to want to look at tends to yield significant benefits, and I think is less polarizing than a lot of other high salient issues. And also, just as I've said 100 times to you, you're probably sick of it, build more transmission.
Well, that's an interesting concept indeed, to build more transmissions. And thank you again for having this wonderful conversation, Professor Macy. And thank you everyone else for listening to this episode of The Robots Are Coming. Next time, we'll have even more great professors at the University of Chicago Law School speak on the topics of energy law, entrepreneurship, public policy, and more. So make sure you subscribe to The Robots Are Coming wherever you're listening to, and tell all of your buddies to do that as well. Thank you so much.
Thanks again for having me. I'm really grateful to stop by.